Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of like extreme precision.
Right, yeah. Like it's a math problem.
Exactly. It feels almost like engineering, you know, like you fall off your bike, you break your arm, and you go to the hospital, and the doctor puts you in front of this X-ray machine, and moments later they slap this backlit film up on the wall, right? And there's that jagged, undeniable white line running right through the
It's
bone.
right there.
Yeah, the doctor just points to it and says, you know, there it is, there's the problem.
Which is it's an incredibly comforting moment, strangely enough.
I'm running. Where are
But yeah,
you?
I mean, we have this deep, deep psychological need for our problems to be visible, right?
Yeah.
To be binary, like it's broken or it's not broken. It just allows us to instantly categorize the threat.
Right. That makes total sense. But then you step out of that clean binary world and you step into the realm of complex systems.
Oh, yeah. That's where it gets messy.
So messy. Whether we are talking about like the delicate architecture of a human brain operating under relentless daily pressure, or maybe a massive interconnected global supply chain spanning 30 different countries.
Yeah, that X-ray machine is just, it's utterly useless in those spaces.
Utterly useless. The damage is there, obviously, but it is completely invisible until the exact moment of catastrophic collapse.
Exactly.
And that invisible damage is really what we're hunting today. So, welcome to this deep dive.
Glad to be here.
If you are listening to this right now, you know, you are probably navigating a world that demands just an astonishing amount from you.
Everyone is.
Everyone. So today we are tearing into this massive stack of research. I mean, we've got neuroscience papers, we've got system theory analyses, organizational psychology critiques.
It's a huge stack.
It really is. And we are looking at the whole concept of resilience. But, you know, more specifically, our core mission today is to just completely dismantle everything society has taught us about grit.
It is such a vital dismantling, honestly. I mean, we have spent decades operating under this paradigm that essentially equates suffering with strength.
Right.
And, you know, these sources finally provide the mathematical and, well, the biological proof that this paradigm is just entirely backwards.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because for our entire lives, we've really been marinated in this idea of toughing it out.
Oh, absolutely. The hustle culture.
Yeah, the hustle culture, the, you know, those motivational quotes on Instagram, the corporate mandate to always like do more with less.
White, it's everywhere.
We are just constantly told that success belongs to the people who can absorb the most friction and just, you know, keep walking.
Yeah.
But the data we are looking at today actually proves that this model of permanent pressure tolerance, it isn't making you stronger.
No, it's not.
It isn't making your company stronger. It is actively engineering hidden catastrophic failures.
Exactly.
So the goal today is to really look at how we can stop demanding invulnerability from ourselves, right? And start building what the sources call actual coherence.
Yeah. And what's incredibly powerful about looking at the neuroscience alongside, you know, organizational architecture is that you start to see the universe operating as a fractal.
Okay, wait, a fractal, meaning like the pattern just repeats itself regardless of the scale you were looking at.
Yeah, exactly. So think about the shape of a river network if you look at it from a satellite.
Okay.
And then, you know, look at the veins in a single leaf.
Oh, wow, right. They look identical.
They do, because the structural laws governing how energy flows, or, well, how systems break down under stress, they don't fundamentally change just because the system gets larger.
That is wild.
It is the exact same biological laws that dictate how a single human nervous system shatters under chronic stress. Intimately mirror the physics of why a massive multinational organization collapses during a crisis.
So, if you want to understand why, say, a hospital system suddenly hemorrhages half its staff,
Right.
or why a massive tech platform suffers this cascading outage, you're saying looking at the balance sheet won't tell you the story.
No, the balance sheet tells you nothing about the structural integrity. You have to look at the biology of exhaustion.
The biology of exhaustion.
Yeah, by actually observing how a human brain physically degrades under relentless pressure, we're basically looking at the exact blueprint for organizational collapse.
Wow. Okay, so let's zoom all the way in on that micro level first. The human brain.
Let's do it.
Because we need to talk about why this pervasive narrative of grit is actually just this profound biological trap.
It really is.
You know, the mainstream definition of grit is usually something like passionate perseverance toward long-term goals.
Right. And it sounds so noble.
It sounds great. We champion it everywhere. I mean, we tell our kids to have it. We write it on employee performance reviews.
Constantly.
But the sources argue that expecting continuous cognitive expenditure, you know, without any cycles of regeneration, it just defies basic biological laws.
Completely. We have built this entire societal narrative around a literal physiological impossibility.
A physiological impossibility.
Yeah. We treat the human brain as if it were a combustion engine, like it just needs more fuel to keep running.
Right. Just pour some coffee in it and go.
Exactly. But the brain is a living ecosystem. It strictly demands these rhythmic cycles of massive expenditure followed by, you know, deep restorative recovery.
Okay, but I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, though.
Sure.
Because the immediate pushback from anyone listening who has achieved a high level of success is going to be, isn't stress the entire mechanism of growth?
I hear that all the time.
Right. Think about lifting weights. You go to the gym, you put your muscle under this intense, agonizing friction.
Yeah.
You literally tear the microscopic muscle fibers, and then your body repairs them, and they grow back stronger.
Right.
So if I want to be a top-tier executive or, you know, a brilliant surgeon or even just a great parent, don't I need to tear the psychological muscle to get stronger?
See, that weightlifting analogy is universally used to justify toxic environments. Mm. But it relies on a complete fundamental misunderstanding of human physiology.
Really? How so?
Because it conflates acute stress with chronic stress. And biologically, those are two entirely different universes.
Okay, walk us through the actual biological difference then. What is happening under the hood?
Well, we need to look at the biology of allostasis.
Allostasis.
Yeah, allostasis is this highly dynamic process by which your brain and your body actually adapt to environmental demands to maintain your baseline stability.
Oh.
So when you encounter a sudden stressor, let's use an evolutionary example, like, I don't know, encountering a predator.
Right, the classic tiger in the bushes.
Exactly. Or, you know, a modern equivalent, like a car swerving into your lane on the highway.
Yeah.
Your body activates two primary emergency systems.
Okay, what are they?
First, you have the sympathetic adrenomedullary axis, or the SAM axis.
SAM axis, got it.
And second, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis.
Okay, so these two axes are essentially like the biological fire alarms.
They're the alarms and the first responders and like the tactical deployment teams all rolled into one.
Mm.
When those axes activate, they trigger an immediate massive release of catecholamines and glucocorticoids.
Which in everyday language means...
We are talking about adrenaline and cortisol.
Okay, the heavy hitters.
Yeah. And in the short term, this response is a masterpiece of evolutionary engineering.
It's because it saves your life.
Exactly. Your pupils instantly dilate to widen your visual field. Your heart rate skyrockets to pump oxygen to your muscles.
Right, right.
But most importantly, your metabolic resources are just ruthlessly reallocated.
Reallocated how?
Well, the brain shuts down long-term projects. So things like digestion, reproductive functions, cellular immune repair.
That just turns them off.
It basically pauses them, yeah. And it dumps all that saved energy straight into immediate muscular readiness and sensory gain.
So you become like this biological machine optimized purely for surviving the next 10 minutes.
Yes, which is brilliant if the threat only lasts 10 minutes.
Ah.
Because the entire adaptive value of this acute stress response relies entirely on its rapid resolution.
Meaning the stress has to end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Once you outrun the predator or you dodge the car, these negative feedback loops in your brain detect that the environment is safe again.
Okay.
They shut off the cortisol drip and your system returns to baseline. That is the true equivalent of your weightlifting analogy.
Ah, okay. You lift the heavy weight, you experience the acute stress, you put the weight down, and you leave the gym for 48 hours to actually recover.
Right. You leave the gym.
But, in a modern corporate environment, or honestly just in modern life with a smartphone constantly in your pocket, we never put the weight down.
No, we never leave the gym. When your environment demands endless grit, the stressor never resolves.
The inbox is literally never empty.
The quarterly targets are always increasing.
Yeah.
The geopolitical news on your phone is always terrifying.
Yeah, it's nonstop.
And because your primitive brain cannot distinguish between the existential threat of a predator and, say, the social threat of a furious email from your boss.
Wait, really? It can't tell the difference?
Chemically, no. So you remain in this state of chronic sympathetic activation. Your body is just pumping cortisol as if you are running for your life, while you are sitting completely still in an ergonomic desk chair.
That's such a wild image, pumping adrenaline while answering emails.
Yeah, and this leads directly to what the medical literature defines as allostatic overload.
Allostatic overload? I mean, that sounds like an electrical grid about to blow.
It's not far off. It is the profound structural wear and tear on the body and the brain. The brain literally gets trapped in this continuous loop of perceived threat.
Man.
And here is the terrifying part. To sustain this level of artificial alertness, the brain actually begins to physically alter its own architecture.
Okay, this was the part of the research that absolutely, like, stopped me in my tracks.
It's mind-blowing.
It really is. Because we are so used to talking about burnout as an emotional state, right?
Yeah.
We say things like, oh, I'm feeling fried, or I'm just so drained today.
Right, like it's just a mood.
Exactly. But we're not talking about feelings here. We are talking about the physical, structural degradation of your brain matter. So let's look at the prefrontal cortex, the PFC.
Okay, so the PFC is the most highly evolved region of the human brain, located just right behind your forehead.
Right.
It is the absolute seat of your highest cognitive abilities. Working memory, cognitive flexibility, impulse control, deep strategic planning, empathy.
So basically, it's the exact part of your brain that makes you valuable in a complex, knowledge-based economy?
Exactly. And under chronic stress, under allostatic overload,
yeah,
it actually physically changes shape.
That is just, it's horrifying.
It undergoes rapid, visible morphological changes.
Wow.
Yeah, the continuous toxic bath of catecholamines, that never-ending drip of stress hormones, it actually starts to suppress neuronal activity.
Okay, how does that work structurally?
Think of your neurons like ancient trees.
Okay.
The dendrites are the elaborate branching structures that reach out to connect with other trees, forming this dense forest of your intelligence.
Right, the connections.
But under chronic stress, a phenomenon occurs that we call dendritic spine loss, alongside the actual debranching of pyramidal neurons.
Okay, so if we stick with the tree analogy, the stress hormones are acting almost like a corrosive acid bath.
Pretty much, yeah.
To conserve energy in a state of constant threat, the tree literally starts pruning its own branches.
Yes, the connections that allow you to hold, you know, a complex strategic thought or to regulate your frustration during a tense meeting, they are physically withering away.
Wow.
The gray matter volume in the medial prefrontal cortex measurably decreases. Your brain is actively disconnecting its own higher level wiring.
That's incredible.
But it doesn't just stop there.
Of course not.
The brain is an economy of resources. So while the PFC is shrinking, the amygdala is experiencing the exact opposite effect.
Oh, right.
It is undergoing hypertrophy.
Now, the amygdala is the primitive threat detection center, right? Like the lizard brain.
Exactly.
And hypertrophy means it is physically growing larger.
Well, it grows denser. The synaptic connectivity within the amygdala increases wildly.
Oh, wow.
It becomes incredibly hyperreactive. So picture the biological state you are now in.
Okay.
You are actively losing your physical capacity to think strategically, to solve complex problems, and to regulate your emotions.
Right.
While simultaneously, your brain's fear center is becoming massive and hypervigilant.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It is. You start perceiving a simple scheduling change, or like a mild piece of constructive feedback, as a mortal threat.
Because your brain is literally wired to see tigers everywhere now.
Exactly. And then, as if that wasn't enough, there's the hippocampus.
Right. The hippocampus. What does that do again?
The hippocampus is the region vital for memory consolidation, spatial navigation, and placing events into their proper context.
Okay.
Chronic stress induces structural shrinkage there as well. The toxic environment impairs neuroplasticity and severely reduces neurogenesis.
Neurogenesis.
The literal birth of new neurons.
Oh, man. So you lose your memory, you lose your ability to learn from new information, and you lose context.
Exactly.
The paradox here is almost, it's cruel. Like, think about what we do in modern business. We construct these incredibly intense, high-pressure corporate environments that demand absolute peak performance.
Constant peak performance.
Right. We demand visionary strategic thinking, flawless execution, and really high emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
But the very pressure we apply to extract that performance triggers a biological state that actively dismantles the exact cognitive architecture required to do the job.
It is a totally self-defeating ecosystem.
It really is.
The brain enters what evolutionary biologists call survival allocation mode.
Survival allocation mode.
Yeah, it looks at the environment, it perceives endless threat, and it systematically dials down the metabolically expensive cognitive functions.
Like pondering a five-year market strategy.
Exactly. It turns that off to preserve energy for immediate survival.
This completely recontextualizes how toxic the whole grit narrative really is.
Completely.
I mean, imagine an employee who is deep in allostatic overload. Mm-hmm. Their PFC is degraded. They start dropping the ball.
Naturally.
They miss a deadline. They snap at a coworker. They can't seem to grasp a new software platform. What does management usually do?
Oh, they pull them into a room?
They pull them into a room, put them on a performance improvement plan, and tell them they've just lost their edge.
Yep.
They are told they lack grit. They just, you know, need to care more and try harder.
It's wild because management is essentially diagnosing a structural neurobiological deficit as a moral failing.
Yes.
They are looking at a brain that has physically pruned its own dendrites to survive the environment that management created.
Wow.
And they are demanding that the employee use willpower to overcome cellular degradation.
Which is impossible.
You cannot willpower your way out of dendritic spine loss any more than you can willpower a broken arm to, you know, lift a heavy box.
Right. Which brings us to the antidote, or rather the biological law that our entire modern working culture tries to ignore.
The absolute necessity of recovery.
Yeah.
Within the framework of neurobiology, recovery isn't a luxury. It isn't a reward you get at the end of the year if you hit your KPIs.
Right, it's not a treat.
No, it is a non-negotiable metabolic imperative. And we can actually measure an organism's capacity for this through a biomarker called heart rate variability, or HRV.
Okay, yeah. I know a lot of athletes and tech-focused people track HRV on their smartwatches now. It's the variation in milliseconds between your heartbeats, right?
That's right.
But why is it the ultimate indicator of resilience? Like, what does it actually tell us?
Because your heart does not beat like a metronome. Or, well, at least it shouldn't. HRV is a direct window into the flexibility of your autonomic nervous system.
Got it.
A high HRV means there is significant variation between beats. It indicates a highly resilient biological system that is perfectly capable of toggling back and forth between states.
Between the sympathetic state, like the gas pedal, the stress?
Yes. And the parasympathetic state, which is the brake pedal, the recovery, the rest.
So if I have a high HRV, my system can flood with adrenaline to handle a crisis. But the second the crisis is over, I can slam on the brakes, calm my heart rate down, and just go to sleep.
Exactly. You are metabolically flexible. But when you are stuck in the allostatic overload of endless grit, your HRV just plummets.
Oh, wow.
Your heart beats rigidly, almost like a metronome, because the parasympathetic brake pedal is completely worn out.
It's just jammed.
Yeah. True cognitive resilience requires the intentional activation of that parasympathetic state. You actually have to achieve deep rest and true psychological detachment from the stressor.
Psychological detachment. I think that is the key phrase there. Because that doesn't mean sitting on your couch watching Netflix while simultaneously checking your phone every 3 minutes to see if your boss replied to your email.
No, not at all. If you are ruminating on the email, your amygdala is still firing. Your HPA axis is still dripping cortisol.
So you are not recovering at all.
You are not recovering. But when you do achieve true parasympathetic detachment, your brain initiates this almost magical process. It releases a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF.
BDNF. Okay, I've heard neuroscientists call this like Miracle-Gro for the brain.
It is the ultimate restorative agent. BDNF is critical for repairing those damaged synapses we talked about earlier.
The pruned branches.
Right. It stimulates neurogenesis. It actually regrows the dendritic branches in your prefrontal cortex.
That is amazing.
But the biological rule is absolute here. Without intentional, psychologically detached recovery cycles, BDNF is suppressed. The system becomes brittle, and you inevitably reach the catastrophic failure state we clinically recognize as burnout.
So we have this really vivid picture of what happens on the microscopic level, right? If you force human biology to endure endless friction without recovery, you cause cellular structural collapse.
Yeah, that's the micro.
Now let's pull the camera all the way back. Let's move from the micro to the macro. Because what happens when we build an entire organization or, you know, an entire hospital network or a massive global supply chain based on this fundamentally flawed premise of endless endurance?
This is where we step into the mathematics of complex adaptive systems.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, because if the individual human brain is the microcosm, the global organization is the macrocosm.
Right, the fractal.
The fractal. And to understand how these massive systems fail, The research looks at four distinct archetypes of structural response to stress.
Okay, let's go through them. The first archetype is the fragile system. And honestly, this one is pretty intuitive. The literature describes fragile systems as highly optimized, incredibly rigid, lacking any redundancy, and highly coupled.
Right. A fragile system is essentially terrified of disorder.
Mm.
Volatility damages it or destroys it entirely.
Give me an analogy.
The classic analogy is a delicate glass vase.
Okay.
It is highly optimized for its specific function, which is, you know, holding water and looking beautiful on a table. But it has absolutely zero capacity to absorb a shock.
Right.
If the table gets bumped, the vase doesn't bend, it doesn't dent, it shatters completely and irreparably.
And in an organizational context?
In an organization, a fragile system is one that operates with zero margin for error. A hyper-optimized supply chain where a delay in one single shipping container halts production globally.
That is a fragile system. And we saw a lot of glass vases shattering during the early days of the pandemic.
Oh, thousands of them.
So fragile is obviously bad. No CEO sets out and says, let's build a fragile system.
No, of course not.
But this is where the research highlights a massive cognitive trap that leaders fall into. In their attempt to avoid fragility, they build the second archetype, which is the robust system.
Yeah.
And they confuse robustness with actual resilience.
It is the most common architectural mistake in modern business, hands down.
Really? Why?
Because robustness is a system's ability to withstand perturbations without altering its internal structure. A robust system is hardened.
Hardened.
Yeah. It relies on heavy defenses, thick boundaries, and rigid protocols. It is designed to resist shocks and remain exactly as it was.
Okay, let's upgrade our analogies here. If the fragile system is the glass vase, the robust system is what, like a massive hardened oak tree?
Yes, a massive oak tree. It has incredibly thick bark, deep roots, a massive trunk. It is designed to stand absolutely rigid against the wind.
Right.
And that oak tree is a perfect representation of the hidden danger of robustness.
How is a big oak tree dangerous?
Well, an oak tree is designed to absorb a very specific, historically predicted range of shocks. So it can withstand winds up to, say, 80 miles per hour without flinching.
Okay.
But complex environments are not defined by historical averages.
Oh, right.
They are defined by nonlinear dynamics. They are defined by black swan events.
Black swan events. That's a term popularized by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, right?
Exactly.
These are high impact, completely unpredictable disruptions that just fall way outside the standard deviation of our historical data, like a global pandemic or a war breaking out overnight. Or a massive AI breakthrough that renders your entire product line obsolete in a week.
Exactly. And when a robust system encounters a stressor that exceeds its strictly designed capacity.
When that wind suddenly hits 120 miles per hour.
It does not degrade gracefully. The oak tree doesn't bend. It resists, and then it violently snaps.
It shatters catastrophically.
Yes. In systems engineering, this is known as brittleness.
Brittleness. I mean, that word is so evocative because it describes a strength that is fundamentally an illusion.
That's a great way to put it. Brittleness is defined as the rapid, catastrophic fall off of performance that occurs when events push a system beyond its boundaries for handling variation.
Wow.
Highly optimized, tightly controlled systems are almost always brittle. If you build a company with no spare capacity, where every employee is utilized at 100%, and you rely on rigid top-down command protocols.
We haven't built a strong system.
No, you have built an oak tree waiting for a hurricane.
The researchers use a phrase that I absolutely love here, graceful extensibility.
Yes, graceful extensibility.
Brittleness is the exact opposite of graceful extensibility. Graceful extensibility is, well, it's the ability of a system to stretch and deform and adapt its shape when the environment does something weird without losing its core function.
Right. And to achieve graceful extensibility, a system requires redundancy.
Redundancy, which management usually hates.
Oh, efficiency experts view redundancy as waste. They say, why pay for two servers when one can handle the load? Why employ 10 people when 8 can do the job if they just hustle?
Right, the grit.
But redundancy is what actually allows a system to route around failure. Without it, a localized disruption, like a single point of failure, it instantly cascades into systemic collapse.
Okay, so we have fragile, which shatters easily. We have robust, which resists until it shatters catastrophically.
Right.
The third archetype is resilient.
A resilient system deforms under stress, but it possesses the elastic capacity to rebound to its original baseline state. It incorporates reactive, adaptive capacity.
Okay, so if we are moving away from the oak tree, what is a good structural analogy for a resilient system? The classic one is usually a willow tree bending in the wind, but let's look at something more mechanical.
Okay.
What about a memory foam mattress? You press your hand into it, which is a heavy stressor, and it completely deforms to accommodate the weight.
Right.
It doesn't break. And when you remove your hand, it slowly regains its exact original shape.
That is an excellent structural metaphor. The memory foam survives the stress and recovers its baseline.
But
notice the limitation there. It expends energy to return to the status quo. It survives, but it doesn't learn from the impression of your hand.
Oh, I see.
It doesn't change its internal chemistry to become better at supporting weight the next time. Which brings us to the fourth and honestly the most advanced architectural state.
Anti-fragile.
Anti-fragile.
This is Taleb's core concept, and it entirely flips our relationship with stress upside down.
It really does. Anti-fragile systems do not merely survive volatility, disorder, and stress.
Right.
They absolutely require those things to learn, grow, and improve.
Wow.
While a resilient system bounces back to its original state, an anti-fragile system bounces forward.
Bounces forward.
Yeah. It uses the stressor as vital informational data to restructure itself into a more capable, highly evolved form.
And the ultimate example of anti-fragility isn't a tree, and it's not foam. It's the human immune system.
It is the absolute masterpiece of anti-fragile design.
Your immune system doesn't just bounce back after fighting off a virus. It literally requires exposure to pathogens to map the environment.
Right.
When it encounters a novel virus, it fights it off, and then it permanently alters its own genetic memory to create antibodies.
Exactly.
The stressor itself makes the system inherently stronger and more prepared for the future. If you take a human and put them in a completely sterile, perfectly safe bubble with zero volatility,
their immune system doesn't remain robust. It becomes incredibly fragile.
It atrophies.
You see the exact same thing in orthopedics with Wolf's Law.
Wolf's Law.
Yeah, bone tissue will remodel and become significantly denser and stronger along the exact lines of mechanical stress placed upon it.
Oh, right. Microfractures from lifting heavy weights cause the bone to calcify thicker than it was before.
Exactly. Biological systems naturally lean toward anti-fragility. However, engineered systems, things like corporate structures, software networks, hospital protocols, they do not do this naturally.
No, they definitely don't.
They must be intentionally architected for anti-fragility.
And how on earth do you architect a company to act like a bone calcifying or like an immune system?
You have to intentionally introduce manageable, continuous stressors into the environment to expose hidden vulnerabilities.
Wait, you want to stress the company on purpose?
Yes. You have to force the organization to learn. An anti-fragile company decentralizes its decision-making. It distributes its infrastructure. And most importantly, it fundamentally changes its relationship with failure.
How so?
It treats failure not as an anomaly to be punished, but as a continuous, vital mechanism for evolutionary feedback. It literally metabolizes volatility.
Okay, that sounds incredible in theory. But if the math and the biology so clearly demonstrate that highly optimized, robust systems are brittle.
Right.
And that we desperately need graceful extensibility.
Yeah.
Why do 90% of modern organizations still operate like rigid oak trees?
It's a great question.
Why are we so obsessed with efficiency over resilience?
Because building redundant, anti-fragile systems requires an investment of time and spare capacity.
And that looks expensive on a quarterly balance sheet.
Exactly. And more importantly, organizations have discovered a very dark, very clever way to hide their systemic brittleness.
Oh, boy.
They mask the flaws of their architecture behind the exhausting, unsustainable efforts of their individual employees.
This is where we cross over into organizational psychology.
Right.
When a company refuses to build structural resilience, it weaponizes the concept of grit.
Yes, it does.
And it does this through something the sources call resilience theater.
Resilience theater. It's the deployment of superficial wellness initiatives that give the appearance of institutional care while completely ignoring the toxic structural reality of the environment itself.
It is pure performance.
Pure performance.
We have all lived through resilience theater. It's when your company announces like a major layoff, forces the remaining staff to absorb all the workloads of the people who were fired.
Yeah.
And then to help with the transition, HR sends out an automated email at 11:30 p.m. on a Saturday reminding you to download a mindfulness app.
Oh, I've seen that exactly.
Or they host a mandatory yoga session in the break room on a Friday afternoon while your inbox is overflowing.
Right.
It's not just unhelpful. it is aggressively insulting.
It is insulting because it is a form of institutional gaslighting.
Gaslighting, yes.
Consider the actual mechanism here. The organization is operating a fundamentally brittle, broken system.
Right.
By deploying resilience theater, the organization actively shifts the moral and psychological burden of that systemic failure directly onto the worker.
So it's basically saying, you're burning out because you're doing the jobs of three people. No, you're burning out because you aren't doing enough deep breathing exercises.
Exactly.
You lack grit. You lack the character to thrive here.
That is the exact underlying message. Interventions that focus solely on toughening up the individual psychology while leaving the toxic structural stressors entirely intact, they demonstrate a profound ignorance of human capacity.
Because, as you said earlier, a person cannot outmeditate a fundamentally broken system.
They can't. When the environment is actively hostile to the biological requirement for recovery, grit is no longer a virtue. It is just a mechanism for accelerated self-destruction.
Man. And this resilience theater is almost always propped up by the most toxic element of corporate life. Hero culture.
Hero culture is the pervasive, systemic normalization of allostatic overload.
Okay, unpack that.
It is an environment where individuals who routinely sacrifice their physical health, who completely obliterate their personal boundaries, and who endure immense, continuous stress to deliver results against all odds.
Right.
They are fiercely celebrated, heavily rewarded, and constantly promoted into leadership.
Okay. I am going to push back on this again, though, because if I put on the hat of a startup founder or, say, a hospital administrator, I might honestly say I need those heroes.
Right. You think you do.
If my server goes down at 3 a.m., I want the legendary 10X engineer who will wake up, drink four Red Bulls, and write 2,000 lines of code to save the launch.
Yeah.
If I'm running an ER, I want the doctor who will work a 24-hour shift to save lives, because they get the job done when the system fails.
They absolutely get the job done in the short term.
So what's the problem?
But look at what is really happening from a systems theory perspective. Hero culture creates a massive, dangerous illusion of robustness.
An illusion?
Yes. Because you have a few individuals who are willing to act as human shock absorbers.
Human shock absorbers.
People who will absorb the immense friction of your broken code or your understaffed hospital. And because they do that, the system appears, from the outside, to be functioning smoothly.
The executives look at the quarterly output and say, hey, look at these metrics. The system works perfectly.
But the system isn't working at all. The heroes are masking the broken processes with their own biology.
With their own burning biology.
Yes. The organization has just become rigidly dependent on the unsustainable endurance of a few key actors.
Which is the definition of a brittle architecture.
Exactly. Because what is happening to the heroes?
Well, based on what we said earlier, their prefrontal cortexes are degrading.
Yes.
Their amygdalas are expanding.
Yeah.
Their HRV is flatlining, and they are hurtling toward absolute burnout.
Precisely. The human shock absorbers eventually break. The hero succumbs to a severe health crisis, or they suffer a total psychological collapse, or they simply walk out the door and quit.
And when that single point of human failure gives way, the illusion shatters.
The hidden systemic vulnerabilities are instantly exposed, and the operational framework collapses.
Huh.
You did not build a resilient organization. You merely exploited a few resilient people until you broke them.
Wow. High-performing organizations recognize that relying on individual martyrdom is just a massive operational risk.
It is.
So if hero culture masks the broken system, how does an organization actually see its own flaws before they cause a collapse?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question.
The sources point heavily to Amy Edmondson's concept of psychological safety. We hear this term thrown around a lot in HR circles.
We do, yeah.
It's usually defined as the shared belief that a team is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. Like, employees can voice concerns, report near misses, and admit exhaustion without fear of retaliation or marginalization.
Unfortunately, psychological safety is usually categorized as just a soft HR initiative.
Right, like a way to make the office feel warmer and fuzzier.
But the research reframes it entirely through the lens of systems engineering. Psychological safety is the sensory nervous system of the organization.
The sensory nervous system, let's expand on that analogy. If my body is an organization, my sensory nerves are basically the frontline workers.
Yes. If you accidentally place your hand on a glowing red-hot stove,
right,
your peripheral sensory nerves immediately fire a signal of excruciating pain to your brain.
Yes.
Now, it is an unpleasant signal, but it is vital. Your brain instantly reacts, and you pull your hand back before the muscle and bone are irreparably destroyed.
A system cannot adapt to a threat it cannot perceive.
Exactly.
I remember reading about the tragedy of leprosy, actually. People used to think the disease itself caused your fingers and toes to fall off.
Right, that was the myth.
But that's not what happens at all.
Yeah.
The bacteria destroys the peripheral nerves. The person literally loses the ability to feel pain.
It's terrifying.
So they reach into a fire, or they wear tight shoes that cause massive infections, and because they feel absolutely no pain, they don't stop the behavior. Wow.
They destroy their own tissue because their warning system is completely offline.
That is a chilling but absolutely perfect analogy for an organization lacking psychological safety.
Because they can't feel the heat.
If a corporate culture relies on fear, intimidation, and heroics, employees are terrified to deliver bad news.
Right.
They won't report that a software patch is flawed. They won't admit that they are too exhausted to perform surgery safely.
The company has literally given itself organizational leprosy.
Exactly. It has severed its own sensory nerves. The leadership is operating completely blind. They lose the vital feedback loops necessary for early error detection and graceful extensibility.
And during a crisis, what happens? Panicked managers almost instinctively revert to command and control tactics.
They demand immediate compliance and silenced dissent.
But the data shows conclusively that organizations with high psychological safety experience significantly lower burnout, higher retention, and much faster recovery during catastrophic shocks. Because when a nurse can look at a doctor and say, "Hey, I think that dosage is wrong," or an engineer can look at a VP and say, "This timeline will break the server."
The system can actually self-correct before the pressure results in brittle failure.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've covered the theory and the biology. Let's look at the historical reality, because the sources provide three major case studies that just beautifully mirror everything we've talked about.
They really do.
Let's start with the most tragic example of robustness and the failure of grit. The 1986 Space Shuttle Challenger disaster.
The Challenger disaster is the definitive case study in how demanding performance over truth destroys a system.
Most people know the physical mechanism of the tragedy, right? On the morning of January 28, 1986, the temperature at Cape Canaveral was unseasonably freezing.
Freezing cold.
The cold weather caused an O-ring in the solid rocket boosters to lose its elasticity. It couldn't seal the joint. Hot gas escaped, and the shuttle broke apart 73 seconds into flight.
Yes.
But the engineering failure was secondary. The true failure happened the night before in the boardroom.
It was a profound systemic failure of psychological safety and a lethal reliance on robust rigidity.
Explain the culture at NASA at the time.
At the time, NASA's operational culture was heavily dominated by schedule pressure and political optics. They were engaged in what the sociologist Diane Vaughan famously termed the normalization of deviance.
Normalization of deviance, meaning what?
Meaning they had seen minor O-ring damage on previous flights. Nothing catastrophic had happened, so they just redefined the risk as acceptable.
But the engineers who actually built the boosters, the team at Morton Thiokol, and specifically an engineer named Roger Boisjoli, they knew how dangerous the cold was.
They knew it intimately. The night before the launch, there was a massive teleconference. The engineers looked at the data and categorically recommended against launching.
So they were acting as the sensory nervous system.
They were. They were sending a loud, agonizing signal of pain to the brain of the organization, warning of imminent destruction.
But management overrode them.
NASA management was appalled by the recommendation to delay. They actually pressured the Thiokol managers to take off their engineering hats and put on their management hats.
Oh, my God.
They demanded that the organization exhibit grit and push through the operational friction. NASA assumed its overarching system was robust enough to absorb the anomaly of the cold weather.
They thought they were the impenetrable oak tree.
They did. And by actively suppressing the pain signal from their own engineers, by prioritizing schedule over truth, they guaranteed a brittle, catastrophic collapse. The system lacked graceful extensibility, and seven astronauts paid the price.
It is such a devastating example. The second case study shifts from, you know, a single fiery explosion to this slow-motion structural collapse that is happening in our society right now,
yeah.
The global healthcare system.
Modern healthcare is a real-time global observation of allostatic overload at scale. For decades, the entire medical infrastructure has relied almost exclusively on the individual heroics and grit of doctors, nurses, and technicians to bridge this widening chasm between inadequate systemic resources and escalating patient needs.
The system didn't invest in spare capacity. It just demanded that a nurse work a 14-hour shift without sitting down.
The medical microsystem is defined by immense cognitive workloads, literal life or death decision making, and profound moral injury.
And rather than addressing the structural drivers of this friction, like the administrative bloat, the insurance hurdles, the understaffing,
the system simply extracted survival from the biology of its clinicians.
And we saw the exact neurobiological outcomes we discussed earlier.
A literal epidemic of burnout.
Emotional exhaustion, widespread depersonalization, structural degradation of empathy. And the systemic response to this crisis was, again, textbook resilience theater.
Hospitals offered wellness seminars and, you know, free pizzas in the break room, while simultaneously increasing patient-to-provider ratios.
And then the ultimate black swan event hit.
COVID-19. The pandemic introduced an unprecedented, sustained shock to an already profoundly brittle system. And the historical reliance on individual grit proved catastrophic.
Because a human clinician cannot persevere infinitely through a structurally dysfunctional environment.
They can't. The system had zero spare capacity. It lacked intelligent feedback loops. It had no institutionalized recovery protocols.
It was a robust system pushed way beyond the boundaries of its design, and it shattered.
And the result is the massive ongoing hemorrhage of medical professionals leaving the field entirely.
Okay, we need some light at the end of the tunnel here. Are there modern organizations that actually understand this? How do we build an immune system instead of an oak tree?
There are, yes.
Yeah.
The sources point to big tech and modern cloud computing as the absolute frontier of anti-fragility in practice.
Yes, certain sectors of software engineering have completely revolutionized how they handle massive systemic risk and complexity.
They have.
The analogy in the research that just blew my mind was how tech companies used to handle high traffic events. Say it's 2012 and an e-commerce giant is preparing for Black Friday.
Right.
They would institute something called a code freeze. For weeks beforehand, no engineer was allowed to update, change, or deploy anything new to the servers. They locked the system down, held their breath, and prayed nothing broke.
A code freeze is a classic archaic robust strategy. You're hardening the boundaries to prevent the variable of human error from entering the system.
But look at the unintended consequences.
By freezing the code, you create a rigid, highly coupled environment. When an inevitable failure does occur on Black Friday, because complex systems always fail.
The engineering teams are out of practice.
Yes. The system cannot gracefully degrade, and the resulting outage is catastrophic.
So how do companies like Netflix or Google or Amazon handle it today?
They have shifted entirely to engineered anti-fragility. Instead of freezing the code, they utilize dynamic release systems.
Dynamic release systems.
This allows thousands of micro changes to be deployed continuously every single day.
Wow.
But the crown jewel of this philosophy is a practice called chaos engineering.
Chaos engineering? It honestly sounds like something the Joker would invent in a Batman comic.
It is brilliant. Netflix pioneered this with a program they literally named Chaos Monkey.
Chaos Monkey.
Yes. Chaos engineering is the practice of utilizing automated algorithms to intentionally inject randomized, localized failures into a live production system while real customers are using it.
Let me make sure I understand this. A company with billions of dollars on the line intentionally writes a program that runs around their servers on a random Tuesday afternoon and just starts unplugging things.
Exactly. Chaos Monkey might randomly sever a major communication pathway, or drastically increase the latency of a database,
or
take an entire data center offline without warning.
That is the biological immune system metaphor brought to life in code.
It is.
They are microdosing their own infrastructure with pathogens.
Consider the mechanism of what happens when they do this. By treating failure as a normal, continuous, and manageable scenario, rather than a rare existential terror,
they force both the technical architecture and the human engineers to constantly adapt.
Yes, the software is forced to learn how to instantly reroute traffic when a server dies, and the engineers get constant, low-stakes practice at diagnosing and fixing problems.
So because they practice failing every single day,
their MTTR, mean time to recovery, drops to almost zero. When a real, unpredictable black swan shock hits the system, it doesn't shatter.
It metabolizes the volatility.
It is structurally stronger because it is continuously stressed in a manageable way.
Okay, so what does this all mean? Bringing this all together, what does this mean for the listener? We can't all write Chaos Monkey algorithms for our HR departments or our local elementary schools.
No, probably not.
How does a normal organization or even a family unit transition from a fragile, grit-dependent state into an anti-fragile, coherent system?
The sources outline a very clear 5-part blueprint for this. They call it the resilience architecture model.
Let's build it out. Pillar one.
Pillar one comes back to boundaries and capacity. The researchers note a fundamental law of physics. In a limitless environment, energy dissipates until exhaustion occurs.
Right.
Boundaries are not restrictions that hold you back. They are the sacred geometry that allows a system to contain and direct its energy efficiently.
In practical terms, this means establishing inviolable limits on workload and ruthlessly prioritizing clarity of direction over sheer volume of effort.
Yes. But the most critical element here is the creation of spare capacity.
Spare capacity. I actually use a traffic analogy to explain this.
Let's hear it.
Think of a major highway. If a highway is at 85% capacity, traffic flows incredibly fast and smooth. Furthermore, if a car stalls in the center lane, the surrounding cars have the physical space to brake, merge into the other lanes, and route around the disruption.
The system has graceful extensibility.
Exactly. But if efficiency experts optimize that highway to 100% capacity, bumper to bumper, using every inch of asphalt, it becomes a highly brittle system.
It does.
Any minor disruption, even just one driver tapping their brakes, causes a massive cascading shockwave that halts the entire highway for hours.
That is the exact mathematical reality of most modern corporations. If every single asset, every employee, every budget dollar, every minute of the day is constantly engaged in primary tasks, you have optimized to 100%.
Which means you have zero spare capacity.
When the environment inevitably changes, you have no freely available agents to pivot, innovate, or route around the problem. Organizations must intentionally design systems that run at 80% or 85% utilization, specifically to leave room for adaptation.
Pillar two of the blueprint is intelligent feedback loops.
A system is only as intelligent as its ability to perceive its own reality. Those feedback loops must be continuous and free of bureaucratic friction.
Which requires dismantling siloed data architectures where departments literally don't talk to each other.
And it requires treating the people doing the actual work as vital telemetry data.
The frontline workers dealing with the daily friction, they're the sensory nerves.
Right. But this raises a profound operational question for leadership. How do you react when an error occurs? If an employee makes a critical mistake, do you fire them to show that you are tough on underperformance? Or do you map the relational dependencies that led to the error?
Well, if you fire them, you just threw away the data.
Exactly. If you map the error through a blameless postmortem, you learn to recognize the weak signals of distress so you can avoid it next time. You prioritize learning over punishment.
Pillar three of the architecture directly addresses the neurobiology we discussed at the start. Institutionalized recovery protocols.
Recovery must be elevated to a non-negotiable operational requirement. It cannot be treated as a reward for suffering.
Just as the human nervous system mathematically requires parasympathetic activation to trigger BDNF and repair cellular damage, an organizational system requires institutional downtime to consolidate knowledge and repair its processes.
This means leadership has to enforce true psychological detachment. It's not enough to say, take the weekend off.
It's implementing protocols where servers delay non-essential emails until Monday morning. It's mandating low-intensity operational periods following massive, high-stakes project sprints. We have to treat rest as a biological law of physics, not a sign of weakness.
Which flows seamlessly into the fourth requirement, building a true culture of psychological safety.
We discussed Amy Edmondson's work, but the practical application here requires a massive paradigm shift. You must create an environment where truth replaces harmony as the ultimate metric of success.
Truth over harmony.
That is incredibly difficult for human beings. We are wired to want our tribes to get along.
Harmony is often just the polite suppression of vital information. To elevate truth, leaders must actively model emotional regulation under extreme pressure.
If a manager freaks out, yells, or becomes visibly anxious every time an employee delivers bad news,
they were actively training the organization to lie to them. They are severing the sensory nerves. Leaders must visibly reward dissenting opinions and celebrate the people who point out the flaws.
And finally, the fifth part of the blueprint, which feels urgent given the current technological revolution, ethical intelligence.
We are rapidly integrating highly advanced AI into these already complex, high-pressure environments.
The integration of AI represents a massive inflection point for systemic resilience. If an AI algorithm is deployed into a complex system without ethical constraints, it will naturally optimize for pure, ruthless efficiency.
It'll look at that highway, see 15% spare capacity, categorize it as waste, and pack more cars onto the road.
The researchers emphasize human-in-the-loop, or HITL, frameworks. We have to ensure that algorithmic decisions don't accelerate the burnout of the human beings forced to work alongside them.
The spirit of the tool is fundamentally shaped by the architect. We must intentionally code our own biological limitations into the AI's parameters. Systems, artificial or otherwise, should not extract survival from biological entities. They should be designed to create a sustainable symbiosis.
We have covered a staggering amount of ground today. We started at the microscopic level, looking at how chronic stress bathes the brain in acid and physically dismantles the dendritic spines of the prefrontal cortex.
We moved through the complex mathematics of systems theory, contrasting the brittle, catastrophic nature of hardened oak trees with the antifragile evolutionary power of a biological immune system.
We explored the tragic historical consequences of resilience theater and hero culture, from the freezing O-rings of the Challenger to the burned-out corridors of modern hospitals. And we looked at how chaos engineering and architectural boundaries offer a new way forward. But it all points to one undeniable, unifying truth.
The era of the endurance narrative is over.
The assumption that human beings and the complex systems we build can infinitely absorb friction through sheer grit is not just an outdated management philosophy. It is a biological impossibility and a structural fallacy.
True resilience is not about toughing it out. It is the graceful extensibility of a system that deeply understands its own boundaries, listens intimately to the pain signals of its environment, and fiercely respects the biological necessity of recovery. We must allow the volatility of the world to teach us how to evolve, rather than simply trying to endure it until we break.
I want to turn this directly to you, the listener. Take a moment and look critically at your own environment. Look at your team at work, your household dynamics, or just your own internal operating system.
Are you operating in an environment that demands permanent pressure tolerance?
Are you relying on your own individual heroics, your own exhausting grit, to mask a fundamentally broken process? Because if you are, the hidden damage is accumulating. The x-ray might look clean today, but the structure is getting brittle. Before we go, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over.
We just talked about how AI needs ethical intelligence and human-in-the-loop oversight to prevent it from optimizing human workers into absolute burnout.
But as AI systems become increasingly autonomous, as they gain the ability to independently analyze and completely redesign their own operational workflows, what happens when an advanced algorithm realizes that the human biological need for rest is the ultimate bottleneck to systemic efficiency? Will a future AI learn to truly architect anti-fragile environments that accommodate and respect our fragile biology? Or will we find ourselves in a terrifying position where we have to constantly fight our own creations for the fundamental right to simply recover?
It brings us right back to where we started.
We need to look past the clean x-rays and start paying attention to the murky, hidden damage before the system shatters. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and remember to keep questioning the narratives around you.